All right, so today let's finish this section, and then we go on to the next section. Remind me to take roll, by the way. It's very important.
Take roll.
Thank you. So the second half of this is mostly about how enzymes are regulated. So first of all, what we know is that the enzymes themselves is going to regulate the expression of these genes, right? So there's a kind of a loop here, right? Because if the enzymes regulate the expression of genes, and then whatever gets expressed are enzymes, then you have this feedback loop, right? For example, there's a lot of regulation in which you confine the enzyme to where they're working in a particular part of the cell, and also so that you are only destroying things that you're going to want to destroy and not other stuff, right? Like lysosomes and stuff, right? And also, there's a lot of regulation in terms of how the functions, the enzyme actually works. So a lot of these changes are reversible. In other words, you attach some group to it and you take some group away. Yeah, so I'll talk about that. So I think the important stuff for this part of the lecture is about the systems of feedback. So how these enzymes can regulate in a general manner. Right? So these are like circuit diagrams. In fact, sometimes, if you look at it that way. So there's negative inhibition, which is when you have too much of a product, for example, it goes back and regulates how this product was initially being formed, you know, the enzyme substrate complex, basically. And then there's also positive feedback, in which it's the opposite. So not enough of a product is detected by an enzyme, and that actually speeds up the reaction. Okay. And then the more that you have it, the more it actually creates. That's positive feedback. Okay, so I'll talk about that in detail later. As you guys probably know from kind of basic chemical processes, that this is kind of called allosteric control, which is what it means is that there's some site that's outside the binding site in which the regulation actually happens. So there's a separate module, separate place where the enzyme is being affected, and binding or regulation at that site causes you to have some conformation change, some deep change in the enzyme itself, and that leads to changes in how well it can work. And a lot of times these changes are subtle. For example, they can be just concentration dependent, which means you move that part of the molecule just a little bit so that now it's still cranking out those products, but just doing so in a slightly less efficient manner or more efficient manner. So kind of like what I was saying before, that you have a case where the ligand binding can also lead to positive or negative changes. So what I said was allosteric control, which is somewhere else in the molecule, somewhere else in the enzyme or protein. But it's also possible that the actual ligand itself binding can lead to a small change in the conformation of the enzyme, and that affects how well the enzyme can operate also. Or it can affect a different part of the enzyme operating. So it's very kind of complicated story, but a negative regulation is what I was saying. So the binding of the actual ligand leads to some movement of some moiety somewhere, amino acid somewhere downstream, and that actually leads to less efficiency somewhere else in the enzyme or in that part of the enzyme. Okay, so this is what positive and negative regulation are. So this is what I was saying about negative regulation. So you have some product, right? So we don't know what this pathway is, but we know that this enzyme, you know, so you study by inhibiting each part of this pathway and figuring out, oh, when you get rid of A to B, you actually get rid of all these products being detected. When you get rid of B to C, these products still go on. You see what I'm saying? That's how people know that it's actually the B that's actually working. But what's shown here is that product Z is actually coming back and inhibiting the synthesis of X. Again, you know that because of the way people study it. They inhibit, or they looked at a solution where there's only Y and no Z, for example, right? And then the Z actually, when you take it away, then, oh, wait, X and Y also disappears. Boom, you know that it's actually affecting the B to X part, basically. Right? And the more you put in, the less you get back. I mean, you get to some steady state where you just have enough Z, no additional level of Z. So that's kind of the negative feedback. So it leads to steady state. It's not just it goes back and inhibit, boom, it does not, now does nothing. It just goes back and say, okay, we had enough. You know, I got Z going up and then going back down, kind of like this. That's what it usually looks like over time.
Yeah. So would it be reasonable to think of it like as a switch that turns on, turns off, like regulates the dial that depends on concentration?
Yeah, it could kind of, you could more or less think of it that way. Like I said, what I said before is that the only thing is that, it's okay. The only main difference here is that the actual switching part of this, right, doesn't actually, it's not dial turning. It's more of a continuous process. You see what I'm saying? It's like once you have a lot of Z, it's like a differential equation. You know, you're a chemist or whatever you are. But it's a differential equation governed process where it's a continuous process where it kind of goes to some steady state. Yeah. But it's basically regulating that switch. Yeah. Okay. But in the real world, it looks more like this, right? It looks more complicated, right? So you have some pathways that's leading to making of these, right? So what is being shown is that you have enzymes that are working to convert aspartate to, you know, they add a phosphate group to aspartate, and then boom, 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 boom. Anyways, you don't have to know the details of this, but the short story is that basically each part of this individual process leads to some product, right? So in this case, lysine, methionine, isoleucine, whatever. And each part of those guys are inhibiting some specific road to get to that, right? It's not just inhibiting this part, but it's inhibiting that part. Same thing with the next amino acid or the next product, right? So you notice actually it's working in different ways. For example, lysine can actually go back and inhibit this section and an earlier section, right? So it's a complicated pathway. You know, it shuts down, it regulates at different points. It can also regulate at different rates. You know, it's more effective at regulating one enzyme versus another. So that's what it looks like in the real cell. This is an example in which, so in this case, you have the molecule binding to some other site, so allosteric control. So the molecule X is binding to some site that is not in the active site, and when it binds it, then kind of this guy changes conformation, that it's, so it's closer like this, and that what that means is now it's easier to get glucose into the enzyme, and therefore to do whatever it's doing. And then so this is what is shown, what we mean when we actually study in the lab, is when you put in this molecule X, these enzymes, which are usually not working so well, in fact, in this picture, it's working 1 out of 10 times, whatever it is. And then when you put in the molecule X, boom, it just increases the efficiency greatly. And so what do you guys think the curve now looks like when you put in this? So remember we were talking about kind of interesting
steeper.
Right, exactly. So we were just talking about how last time we have these curves. When you look at the velocity and the concentration, right? And before it looks kind of like this. So you know what he was just saying, that when you have this molecule X, now the enzyme becomes more able. So what that means is that you can actually positively and negatively regulate these enzymes very easily. Okay, so this is a different one, right? This is negative regulation. So you put it in, and then boom, it changes so that the glucose now doesn't bind so well. Same idea. So from 100% active to 10% active. Okay. You're just missing half the exam material, that's all. one of the important regulations of function of the enzyme is phosphorylation, right? So when they say cooperative enzymes. What that just means is that when you make that change that I was talking about allosterically at some part, different part of the protein or enzyme, it leads to kind of enzymes changing things together. So in other words, a group of enzymes in this complex changes together so that it's not just one enzyme changes shape. It's that when one enzyme changes shape, the one that's next to it also changes slightly so that the entire complex is moving. It's kind of like, what's a good example? Like, I can only think of heavy machinery, you know, like you pull out some plug in the heavy machinery and then all of a sudden the entire thing rotates, you know, even though you've only moved, changed one.
You use like enzyme and complex interchangeably there, or you use different things?
When I say enzyme, that's just a single enzyme. So remember, these are most enzymes are multi-enzyme complexes, right?
Okay.
That's what I meant when I said that. Like, you know, the, I guess the easiest. Ooh, I'm using the board so much. More than I've used the entire. So I'm even changing. Oh no, I'm not changing. I will change the color. Eventually. So most enzymes are found in these. You know, so if I write down the kind of allosteric site, more or less. All right, so most of the time, okay, I'm sticking that part down. But it's something like this, right? Gun barrel shape. So what I'm saying now is that a lot of times what happens is, you know, you have some regulator that's binding to this guy. It moves it so that's, right? So, Star Wars, okay? Dun, 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 dun. And then this one changes, and this one now moves a little bit. That leads the next guy to move a little bit. You see what I'm saying? This whole complex is being regulated as a whole. Yeah, that's what I mean by kind of this cooperativity of the enzyme. And that's, you know, I think of it as kind of like Japan, right? It's like one person moves, and the entire group moves it with them. All right, hopefully that helps your exam. Okay. Now, phosphorylation is one of the kind of main regulators, right? So remember, phosphate, you got two minus charges, right? I'm going to get to use the board again. This is great. I mean, I don't really need to, but, you know, it's this group, right? The phosphate with the oxygen coming out, right? But anyways, this group happens to have two negative charges on them when you count everything together because there's some covalent bonds on the other end. So what that means, first of all, is that it's attracting the positive charges, right? So remember a lot of the, remember I said about enzyme binding sites, a lot of times they have these positive moieties. Some of them have negative also, but, and that kind of leads it to kind of work in a, you know, a better way, for example. So that's first, you're kind of attracting positive charges. You can also attract positive charges from just your environment, right? It also makes this binding cell now being more recognized, right, because of that negative charge. And so phosphorylation is one of the key ways of regulating the enzyme. So now what I want to talk about is basically two main other types of enzymes that is specifically there just to regulate. You guys are all nice and early. That's great. Specific. You missed the whole story. Movie's over. Bye-bye. See this one? Star Wars. Dun, 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 dun. Okay. Two other main types of enzymes, which actually work to regulate other enzymes. And so the names of these you do have to know. One is the kinases, and one are the phosphatases. And they kind of sound like what they do. So kinases, you add phosphate groups, right? Now, adding that phosphate group most of the time is activating, but it could inactivate. You can also inactivate by phosphorylation, right? Because you're adding negative charges, what if your enzyme is actually supposed to bind negative charges, right? Now it's repelling what it's supposed to be getting. So it is possible to negatively regulate using phosphorylation. And then phosphatases just removes these phosphate groups. But again, most of the time, that will actually inactivate because you're getting rid of these moieties that actually help the enzyme. But it can also be possible that it's activating by removing, because That phosphate group was there to inactivate. Now you remove it, it's actually active. That's also possible. Yeah.
So they spring back together as soon as you remove that circle. Like in your gun barrel thing, if you remove the circle, everything switches back to its original configuration.
Right. So this depends on which complex, right, obviously. So in this case, what I'm saying here is that the most likely, that's a good question, by the way, most likely this enzyme has multiple sites, right? So something like this. And what happens is that these other sites has different efficacies, right? So in other words, if you bind that site, then you need to change the whole complex, you know, for kind of all or nothing response. But if you have a large concentration of that, then boom, this whole thing moves. But what you were saying is also possible where it's kind of like, you know, one of those things where it's very critical. Like, you want to turn this enzyme down as soon as, like, it reaches a certain level. Then it's like, boom, right? This guy, single guy comes in and it's like, it moves this. Star Wars repeated episode 3. This whole thing moves together cooperatively as a Japanese society, and it becomes, you know, inactivated or activated as you like. Great questions. Nice and early in the morning. I'm already awake. Come on, guys. All right. So what we're talking about, kinase and phosphatases, so you guys should really know that, right? So that's key, okay. So there's also there's different forms of kinases. So for example, there's this thing called cyclin-dependent kinases. You guys have heard about this before? So those are actually kind of part of the cell cycle, right? So the question was why the cell, you know, dividing and then like making DNA and then, you know, dividing again. So what happens is actually it turns out that these kinases, which are called cyclin-dependent kinases, actually kind of phosphorylate different groups so that when this thing called cyclin, which actually indicates which part of the cell cycle you're at, so when those guys bind, now they become active, and when they're active, they phosphorylate threonine in different parts of the cell, basically different kinds of proteins, and also, you know, a lot of times they phosphorylate tyrosine. I mean, it's not important exactly what they're doing, but basically they phosphorylate at different places, and boom, you get the cell cycle continuing. So that actually, if you notice, is what? Positive feedback, right? That's not negative anymore, right? Boom, the cyclin comes in, boom, you phosphorylate, that phosphate leads to more phosphorylation. Right? So that's an example of positive feedback. Other examples, SDR, SRC, tyrosine kinase, it removes this. You know, so a lot of times it acts at the terminal ends also. I guess that's why I put it here. And it activates specific domains in the protein. It doesn't have to activate the whole protein. It could also activate just this thing called the SH3 arm of the protein, and now that becomes active, only that part. Okay. Man, I really took my time on this. Let's see. Okay. Let's move on. Right. Okay. So, this is kind of similar to what I was talking about. When you have cooperativity, I didn't say it this particular way before, but when you have one subunit, it kind of acts a certain way. So when you increase the concentration, the activity enzyme decreases. So it's looking at activity now. That's why it's not the curve I showed you before. So activity-wise, when you have increase in concentration, it goes down, right? Because it's negatively feedback, okay? So what I was saying about cooperativity is that what happens is that actually changes the way that it's being negatively inhibited by this molecule, so that you get increased efficiency in negative inhibition when you have these subunits grouped together, right? That's what I was saying, because when you put in one, that affects all four. Is anybody okay with that? Is it clear? So what I showed in this picture is basically what is shown here, because one site binding affects everybody else, cooperativity, and that changes the modulation of the inhibitor. Because when the inhibitor usually works, it's a curve that just looks less steep. But now, when you have the enzymes being grouped together, that inhibitor works more than one site, basically. Even though it is working in one site, it leads to changes downstream of that Star Wars. And then it becomes cooperative. I mean, it is cooperative. Therefore, it's having bigger effects. All right. So that's something else that you're getting, not just from the enzyme but itself, but from the cooperativity.
But when in the beginning the complex enzyme is less likely to be affected by the inhibitor?
At the what were you saying?
I mean, the first part.
Yeah. Here, right? Oh, I see. That's a good question. Yeah. So this is the kind of, you know, bare nature of the... So what the first point is saying, right, is that when you have the inhibitors at lowest concentration, it doesn't mean it's zero, but it's low, then it doesn't affect the activity of the enzyme so much. So it's pretty much near 100%. So in that case, it doesn't matter how many subunits it have, it's still cranking it out at the same rate. You see what I'm saying? So you're basically saying why this is kind of the same here, right? So
I think it's just that blue point, yeah? Like, does it take more, just a little bit more inhibitor to actually start getting the four subunits to go down?
Oh, I see what your question is. So your question is, why is there an inflection point at this 50, whereas it's not up here on this 100?
Yes.
Yeah, so that is a kind of a... Okay, maybe it's a little bit complicated to get into. Yeah. So basically the idea is that the way that the inhibitor works has a certain, you know, 50%, you know, area. So which means, you know, so first let's just look at one subunit, right? So with this particular enzyme, when you increase the concentration, it gets to a certain point where the 50 is, and from that 50 on, the activity enzyme is now reduced, right? So it's above 50 or below 50. But at that point, the enzymes are cooperative in the sense that that's exactly the point where the inhibitor concentration is kind of overcome by the enzyme cooperativity. You see what I mean? So that it doesn't... It's hard to explain exactly, but at that particular point, actually it didn't matter how many subunits you have because that level of inhibitor does just exactly the same amount at all three situations. I mean, you might not have to worry too much, but you see what I'm saying? But beyond that point, it's basically changing the way that the inhibitor works, basically changes based on how many subunits it has. When you're above, this point is easy to understand, right? When you're above that, you know, so clearly when you inhibit just a little bit more and you have a lot more subunits, it goes down, right? So that's clear. But on the other direction, when the inhibitor is a little bit less, actually, it's actually a little bit more active. You know, so it's kind of like a negative, the reverse of the, it's kind of a positive effect, in fact. All right, so, yeah.
First off, what are the bottom dots mean? What are the bottom dots?
It's just saying, so imagine these are three different test tubes, right?
Yes.
So in one test tube, you add some inhibitor concentration, so this is that extra molecule X, right? And then you measure how active the enzymes are by looking at the Vmax and then calculating from there, etc., right? So what this means is that you need to add more inhibitor in order to have the same effect, right? The same activity.
They're just giving you a point of reference then.
Exactly. So what the experiment is, you just keep adding the inhibitor until you get that rate, basically.
And these graphs, like one subunit would be like an order one differential equation, four subunits would be a order four differential equation.
Well, I don't know if I can really say that. So it depends on what the graph looks like. So when you model it, so for example, right, with this one, right, it looks like it's lacking this extra inflection point, so which means it's going to be parabolic in shape, more or less, right? But when you add in the extra subunits, your intuition is correct. So basically what you're saying is, when you add in the extra subunits, now you cannot model it anymore by simpler parabolic terms. You need like an x to the third, an x to the fourth term. Which makes sense, right? Because when you have cooperativity, you have extra guys you need, parameters you need to fit, basically. Yeah. So, I mean, don't worry about this part so much. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit tricky, but it's not, you can understand it, but, you know, but basically if you understand this part, it makes a lot of sense. Right? That's just saying that it's actually being going the other direction.
Will you ever test on graphs like this?
It might, yeah. It might. But it will be reasonable. It will be something you can answer based on what we said. Okay. All right, here we go. So I'm going to try to move on a little bit more quickly here. Try to finish this and go to the next lecture. Okay, here we go. So what this is saying is it's kind of giving you a mechanism for what it could be happening, right? So similar to what I was saying, you put in the inhibitor, boom, it changes one part of it, right? But this is the hard part. But once you change it, then whatever additional steps to get the other guys in line is much easier. So in this case, I just said everything moved as in one, but a lot of times you change this, and then you change only the cooperativity of that, right? The ability to bind the allosteric modulator. It doesn't mean it changes the actual activity. So that's what is shown here. So that if it's going like this, then it changes the shape of the molecule in such a way that now it's easier to bind the inhibitor. Right? It has nothing to do with substrate, just the inhibitor in this case. Yeah.
Vocabulary. What's the opposite of inhibitor? Or?
Yeah, activator. Okay. You're either activator or inhibited. Okay, so hopefully that makes sense. So examples of phosphorylation. So this is why it's two O groups, right? So I forgot the double bind here. yeah, so for example, you have a protein kinase that's working at a serine. So it's like a serine protein kinase, right? So first of all, you need to have ATP. That's kind of important. You need to hydrolyze ATP to get this reaction to run. But when you do that, you attach that phosphate group there, and now it's kind of more active because it's changing that active site a little bit, you know, or changing some other part of the enzyme as well. And again, the phosphatase removes that so that you're getting a different looking enzyme, probably inactivated, right? So the lower graph shows what I said, which is you can have kinases actually turning off enzymes and phosphatases turning it on instead. And that's just saying that basically the phosphate group now is sitting somewhere where it's actually kind of inhibiting the reaction. Right, it's less likely to go on. So that's also possible. This is something we kind of already talked about. So in this graph, what they're showing is that you have the phosphate there, and actually that changes the structure in such a way, and that actually leads to activation of this SH3 domain by the binding of the ligand. And then now, once that moves, then the kinase now can do other stuff. So it's a very complicated thing, right? It's kind of the kinase comes in and works somewhere, changes the binding site in such a way. Now when it binds, it leads to further changes that leads to phosphorylation possible, blah, blah, blah. Basically, that's what I'm saying. It's that in the actual cell, it's actually more complicated. Right. So people would like to think of this as like kind of input-output model. So this is not so important, but the idea basically is just saying that that enzyme itself has many complex ways of being regulated. So it's actually reading out some code. So first you see, okay, is that phosphate group there? Okay, well, you know, if that phosphate group, you know, is there, I guess in this case, then do you have the binding of the ligand there? Well, if you have the binding of the ligand and the phosphate from that side, then you said, does my phosphate from the other side come in? If all three things are happening, then the activity is on. You see what I'm saying? So this is giving you, remember, this is actually giving you this pathways, right? Remember, this pathway is saying, for example, here, you need three things, right? Perfect example. Textbook is really good. So you need all three guys. This guy has to be there, plus this guy, plus that guy, in order for you to have nice inhibition, right? So how do you get that? Well, this is what we're saying. You need to have some binding there of that thing at some moiety and phosphorylation of this and phosphorylation of that in order for you to have, in this case, activity actually, but same idea. Right. So you're building kind of logic gates from enzymes. Engineering. Now, you can also regulate these guys using... these GTP moieties, right? These GTP molecules. So this is kind of in addition to phosphate groups. So you have a phosphate actually that's binding to the GDP form of a protein, and that leads to its GTP active form. So it's also binding a phosphate, but now it's acting at GTP, GDP. Okay? And when you have that binding, actually it changes the way the protein moves. Yes? No? Okay. So, for example, one of the famous ones is GTP-RAS, which is a growth factor. So that is a GTPase, which means it has GTP on it, so that it can be, so that phosphate activity on the GTP, GDP can affect the way this enzyme works. And once it's on, it actually goes out and phosphorylates other guys. So you don't have to know every detail of this, but so what happens is basically you have other proteins that are important for this process. So you have this GTP activating protein, GAP, right? Those guys actually hydrolyze RAS, so you convert that GTP to the GDP to make it inactive. And then you have these guanine nucleoside exchange factor, GEF, which in this case, actually, you release that GDP there, and then actually, if you release the GDP, that allows GTP to come in. So it's actually a different form of regulation. It actually wants to release it, because when you release it, that GTP is sitting around and coming in. Yeah.
So what is the difference between adenosine triphosphate and guanine triphosphate? Like, one's an energy provider, and what's this then? A regulator entirely?
Yeah, so the ATP-ADP is purely kind of an energy... currency. But in this case, this guy's actually more like this kinase phosphatase kind of activity. So in other words,
enables and inhibits reactions.
Exactly. So this molecule itself actually is found in different places in the proteins, and the way it works is using these other enzymes. So you can kind of think of the GAP as kind of phosphatase-like thing, and GEF is kind of like a kinase-like thing, because they're both affecting.
So, yeah. Follow-up, do the other two base pairs also have a diphosphate and triphosphate form?
Not as much as this. This is kind of the main, the guanine guys are the main ones that are actually doing this. Yeah. So, just an example, there's this protein that actually binds tRNA, so I'll talk about detail, we'll talk about that in the next part of the course, but and then you have a ribosome that actually is being hydrolyzed. So you have a GTP that's hydrolyzed to GDP. And so when you bind closely, when this GTP actually goes there and binds, it actually activates it, and then you're able to kind of detach the helix and do other things. So anyway, it's a protein that's being modulated by GTP-GDP activity. So quickly, this is what it looks like. GTP is bound in that case, it's being active, and when you hydrolyze that phosphate out, so in this case, it's not some kinase coming in and doing this, right? It's some other GAP, most likely.
So you don't need two separate molecules for this to proceed. It's like all in one?
Right, well, it depends.
Once you bite off the PO4 and then the GDP to absorb the PO4, or...
Right, it's still similar in some sense because you still need that GAP or GEF. But I'm not showing those details in this picture. But it's similar in some sense. It's just a different way of regulation. It's a little bit more complicated because it's able to, those GAP and GEFs are now can be modulate in very fine ways, and you know. But what you should know is just basically that you can modulate function of the activity in the enzymes this way as well. So in this case, when you have the GTP binding, the GT it comes off. So the reason why it's more complicated now is because the on and off rates for the GTP and GTP is now different in this case. So what it's basically saying is that to turn the enzyme from off to on is actually really easy because the GTP binds very easily. This is why you have the aforementioned GEF molecules, because those guys actually regulate how well the GTP can come in. So it's kind of bidirectional in some sense, because that GTP always wants to come in, so you want to regulate how well that is being used. Whereas in the kinase and phosphatase case, it's more like, okay, I have some phosphate group, boom, I'm activating you, boom, I'm inactivating you. In this case, it's more, it has to do with the rate of reaction that's natively actually present. All right, okay, I need to move on, actually. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. So the GTP and GTP are actually acting as regulators in that way. Yep. Yep. Positive and negative feedback. Okay. So this is kind of what GTP ACEs look like. So basically, they have a domain that has these GTP on them, right? The triphosphate, and then you have a site where you can hydrolyze the GTP. GTP. So the difference here is that it's not just a phosphate group going in, it actually has this moiety that's actually, you can modulate more finely. You have signal in and then signal out. So, I mean, basically it's the same idea, but this is what I was just saying with the GEF and the GAP, right? So with the protein kinase, it's very simple, right? Basically, you put on the phosphate, turn it on, you take it off, and it's off, right? But in this case, it's a little bit more complicated because actually the GEF is actually just kind of exchanging these GDPs and GTPs in and out. And actually, natively, it actually has a GDP sitting there. I mean, you have that part of your molecule. That's why these guys are called GTP ACEs, is because they are natively actually a enzyme that contains GTP activity, right? And when you put on that phosphate group, now it becomes a GTPase, and it actually does other things downstream, right? Okay, so I mean, basically the same idea, though. Nothing special, really. I'm going to kind of skip this, but it's the same idea. It's just saying that when you put on that phosphate group, now the protein changes, right, on the right side, basically, right? So this is the example that I gave before with the DNA binding protein. Okay. Now, the phosphorylation, in addition to how you position these proteins in this matrix of the cell, basically, affects how they're being regulated and how diversely they can regulate. So, for example, these are kind of examples, but you have motor proteins, so you probably heard of actin, myosin, these kind of proteins. So what they do is they couple the ATP hydrolysis to actual changing of the head of the molecule. So the different parts of proteins actually conformationally look like. So you bind ATP, you boom, you move the molecule one way, and then these guys slide over, and then you release the ATP and it goes back to that shape. So that's how you have this, you know, muscle movement. Yeah. There's also these guys called ABC transporter. I don't know why it's called ABC. It's called ABC transporter. I left them blank, ABC. Yeah. Okay, ABC transporter, and then it kind of basically pumps out so these hydrophobic moieties outside the cell, basically. And those guys actually also are activated using ATP hydrolysis. You have this other thing called ubiquitin ligase. So ubiquitin is something that you put on a protein or a molecule to indicate that now this guy needs to be destroyed. That's what cells do. They put on, so it's a very fine-tuned process, right? They figure out that this guy is doing all this crazy stuff we don't want. You put ubiquitin on it. And actually, a lot of people think the Alzheimer's disease is the misfunction in that, actually. So it's actually really important. So, you know, it's tricky. But you put that ubiquitin guy in there, actually it's kind of a little bit of positive feedback process how they put it on. But anyways, once they put it in there, other guys come in and recognize the ubiquitin, and once it figures that out, it's actually marking it so that you know that it's being it has
so
been
this
destroyed.
Is the antibody for antigens. Ubiquitin is still lysine as antigen is antibody. Is that fair to say?
Not really, because ubiquitin is something, it's a little bit special kind of a thing. Like, it's something in the cell that when they see it, they go like, okay, like some other, like lysozyme or something. I don't know the details, but lysozyme or something comes in and needs to degrade this in a certain way. I don't know if it's, you know, but it's what you're right about is that it is a kind of different marker. So there's just many different markers, and the marker leads to different changes based on the receptors that recognize those markers. You have also what I was just saying before, scaffolding protein. So what those guys are basically is that it's actually very... So one thing we know is that scaffolding protein is more common than people expected. So the example I have here is coulin, which is basically they concentrate themselves in a different part of the cell, right? And so, for example, if in the vesicle you have a lot of coulin, then what happens is that actually because the coulin binds kind of a protein very well, so it's kind of a hook onto some protein. You have that coulin there, boom, you see a protein that's like it's grabbing it, right? Because of that, you're concentrating more of that enzyme in that vesicle, for example, because of these scaffolding proteins, right? Without membrane. So if you have a membrane, there's less lead to do that because you have receptors. But so what these guys are saying is actually a lot of times when you don't have a membrane, like a vesicle thing, without that even, you have certain part of the cell, for example, in the nucleus when you need to do things to the chromosome, you kind of concentrate a specific protein in that area using other proteins. So that's what we mean by scaffolding. And that is a way of regulating, right? Because you're concentrating these proteins at places that you don't normally expect. And the way you do that is you have this other protein, which is scaffold. Yeah. So there's an example of what the actual myosin guys look like. So again, when the protein binds, this is like some dude walking. When you have the hydrolysis of ATP, boom, it kind of snaps back into place. And when you release it, it goes back out. And when you're doing each point of this process, it binds to the next, to the little blue tape, and then it moves on to the next part of the blue tape, right? Based on a cycle of the ATP binding and unbinding. So the actin is that blue tape I was just saying. Looks like some dude walking. I don't have too much more to say about this. ABC transporters are regulated by ATP. Maybe that's why it's ABC. I don't know. Maybe ATP is in the name of ABC. Don't quote me on that. Okay. And then ubiquitin is complicated. You're not going to need to know this. But I think the important... So what I did fail to say a little bit earlier is that coulin can also be part of a protein. So that I didn't kind of say so well. So I was kind of mentioning it as if it's another protein, but actually it can just be part of a protein. And so what that means is that constitutively, that protein is automatically kind of built to be at a certain part of the cell. Because if the scaffolding is kind of built on the protein, then it's going to want to concentrate automatically at certain parts of the cell that has certain scaffolding components. Okay? All right. So the coulin is actually the thing that's concentrating on it, and then there's some scaffold that it's binding to. Okay. So there's also kind of more complicated things where the scaffolding protein is actually helping to make the enzyme shape nice, basically. So in addition to concentrating on different parts of the cell, for example, there's also kind of this activity where the proteins cooperatively interact when you have molecules coming in on the binding site so that when these guys are actually binding, it actually likes to form a certain core in this case. And when you form that core, boom, that enzyme is now nice and active, right? It's very Star Wars-like, right? It's kind of boom, 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 and then kind of a center forms, boom, once a center forms, you know it, now it can act, cranks out the product, right? Anyways, the details is not so important. And then just a kind of final thing is that a lot of people are now doing protein analysis computationally. In a course like this, you know, when I learned it even, right, a few years ago, people don't talk about this at all. But now, computation is really important. I mean, everywhere, right? Genetics, protein analysis. So what we like to say here is that the protein, what they call proteomics, right, genomics, proteomics, is actually really important to figuring out how the proteins are acting, right? So so what I was saying about this combinatorial code, so the combinatorial code I was saying earlier is where you have, remember that picture where you have the enzyme and you need to have some ligand bind and some phosphate active and some other phosphate active here in order for it to happen. That's the combinatorial code of the enzyme because it needs all three to actually go. Right? So you can actually now modify the protein at different sites so that the combinatorial code is kind of affected. So in other words, you can regulate the way that the ligand binds, then it becomes a binary process, right? You just need phosphate plus phosphate. You can get rid of that phosphate activity with some GTP or whatever you want to do, and boom, it becomes a, you know, binary process this way. You can make it a unitary process. You know, so there's just many ways of modifying that code, in fact, right? And what happens is that now people like to think of proteins interaction in a network. It's no longer just this protein active, you know, getting something happening. It's actually very, I can show. This is the kind of stuff people are studying, right? You have kininocore, I'll talk about later, basically has to do with the cell cycle pulling molecules apart, chromosomes apart. And then you have other enzymes that's regulating different parts of the cell cycle, replication, et cetera, et cetera. They're all related to each other in the sense that one positively or negatively modulates the other. And the protein sequences look alike in different ways. So they're kind of linked together in different ways. And all these guys, including that scaffolding culin that I was saying, is related to everybody else. Complicated mess. How do you understand this? You have to use computation. This is what protein omics gives you. It kind of looks at the structure, it looks at activity. You know, it's basically combining two pieces of information. One is how the structures are alike. That's how you figure out whether, you know, for example, this blue stuff, right here. This stuff right here, blue stuff. How are these guys related? Well, that's probably hypothesized by some computer guy sitting there and going like, oh, wait a minute, this protein and that protein and that protein, they all have these very remarkably similar sequences. They must be similar in some way. Let's run the simulation to see how they're folding. Look at the three-dimensional structure. Yeah, it really is like some protein family. You put that in one family.
By sequence, you mean their amino acid chains.
Exactly, right. So that's one thing. So the one thing is the sequence of activity, you know, the sequence of what they look like, how they can be similar. But the other thing is the function, right? Because the function is the other piece that the computational guys don't really have. That's the kind we study, basically, right? Because you know that this protein, when it activates, it inactivates this other protein or something like that. So that also forms kind of a network dynamics there. When you combine those two pieces of information, that gives you the overall picture of, you know, where this protein is acting, how can you predict whether this protein is doing this or that. So that's where the computation comes in. Okay, I know I need to move forward. So the way you study this also, with the second part of what I just said, functionally, is a lot of times you use this yeast 2 hybrid, is to figure out how well the proteins can interact with each other. Kind of, we talked about this at some point earlier. And that gives you functional information. But now you can put that data into your network. So in addition to the sequence data, now you put on the how well they're interacting together in the yeast 2 hybrid information. put those two pieces of information, you get this complicated structure, a network. And also, the final thing is just that, so now a lot of times when you're looking at what proteins do in humans, it's actually what it's doing in model organisms, right? Yeast and whatever, flies and stuff like that. So really, you're collecting all this information, and then you're going into the human and see, figuring out whether it's actually doing what it's doing. We already talked about this. So basically, given what we can say, it can do kind of logic operations. That's what the combinatorial code means. So, you know, we know that basically even with ands and ors, you can kind of do everything. So therefore, you can do everything you want, more or less, computationally. Okay, so let's, very quick, this is very simple. So I give you just, you know, short amount of time, even without music, or maybe just me jumping around singing, and but I will give you candy, whoever wants to answer.
This again?
Yeah. But I love this question. This is one of my favorite questions in the test. So, because it's very, it's not, it's, it just, it's logic a little bit more. Dun, 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 dun. So you guys know, who wants to answer this question? Who wants candy?
Are those two separate questions, or is one directly linked to another?
It's separate.
Okay.
But you know what? Just to motivate you guys further, Twix.
Oh my god.
Wait. Oh my god, right? It's not better than and sisters, Twix, you're working for bigger yields here. Answer the question. So the protein of interest is Z. Okay, so what is Z? So you should be able to narrow it down to 2 very quickly. And then from there, okay.
Did I explain it first?
Just give the answer first.
Okay. You're ready to throw it at me? It is, it's, like, as you can see, that arrow, it gets a P.
Give me the friggin' answer first.
And then it gets rid of the P to X, so it acts as a phosphatase.
What do you think is the answer?
Kinase. So, kinase is activated A.
Wrong.
A.
Next.
E.
There you go.
Yeah.
This is the guy. Okay. Good try. That was good. You were quick on the trigger. It's like, it's not that one. Boom. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. So first of all.
Yeah,
I know. It's okay. So first of all, so I want everybody to understand this because it's my favorite question, right? So everybody has to understand this first, okay? So first of all, the first arrow you look at is this arrow here, right? Because the question is, what is Z doing? Well, what Z is doing is removing a phosphate group from X whenever it sees X with a phosphate group. When you remove phosphate groups, what are you? Phosphatase. So first of all, you can eliminate all this shit up here. Right? It's not a kinase, right? I mean, it's clearly not a kinase, the first one.
I didn't see the arrow I was pointing at. It's like, you're right on the black.
It's okay. I know. You're going to get your candy at some point. Too bad. I already gave it away. Okay, so then the other thing is what Mark is, right, basically he's saying. So is that, well, now that you know it's a phosphatase, what is it that is regulating it? What is the thing that is regulating it? That's kind of the second part of this sentence, right? But you notice what happens is that this Y actually phosphorylates it. So in other words, it's only active when it's phosphorylated, and it's phosphorylated by some other protein Y, right? So therefore, it's a phosphatase that is activated by phosphorylation because it's only active at phosphorylated areas. If this arrow, instead of starting here, if it started here, then what is the answer?
Yeah,
inactivated.
Exactly, it would be D. It's still a phosphatase, but then it's inactivated by phosphorylation. You guys get that? Very important. The exam is not, I'm not going to give you the answer. I'm going to want you to think about, okay, what it's actually going to be. Okay, good. So then what that means is we're finished with this portion. So before I move on, I just want to say probably, most likely, I'm not going to be able to go over everything in chapter 5. Okay? So chapter 4 will be fine. And what I mean is lecture 5 will be fine. So actually, lecture 5 is really long, if you can see it. There's actually 87 slides. So it's actually meant for 2 days, kind of a thing. Okay, so what that means is that probably we're going to finish this before the midterm and then move on just to the start of replication, something in that ballpark. And then from there, we're not going to do all the complicated details of homologous recombination and DNA repair. We might get to a little bit if you guys are kind of gung-ho.
It's basically a colon table.
Hmm?
Colon table.
No. It's not a codon table, although codon table is important. But, you know, so basically, this part is actually more general because I'm talking about, in general, the structure of nucleic acids and then to chromosomes and genomes. Actually, again, the beginning part is important because I want you to know the structure of DNA very well and things like that. But what I'm saying is that beyond kind of replication and recombination stuff, it's going to be probably a little bit, Tom will talk about some of it, but there's also some details that will necessarily be skipped because I only have two more. I have two more. Because it's next Tuesday and then the Tuesday after and then the midterm.
Oh, no.
And everything before, everything that I finished that Tuesday before the midterm will be, you will have to theoretically know. So in other words, you have only 1 week to study for the final part, but I'll make sure that it's not something that you can't overcome. So one possibility is like we finished everything except for the entire last chapter on that last week, but I'm not going to expect you to know the entire chapter from 1 week because usually that's like a month in the UCs, for example, right? So okay, so instead of talking about that, I think I should take advantage of my time. Okay, so first, I want to say, you know, kind of why we're interested in this, right? So first, you have genetic material that's found within the cell, right? So you have cells that are dividing and non-dividing, and then what that's doing is actually partitioning out genetic material. Now, we know that actually it's coded by DNA, right? So there's actually earlier... Do I have it here? Yes. So let me go to this slide real fast. So there's actually studies in which what happens is that they fractionate these cells, right? So first you have, let's just go through the scientific logic for how this happens. So first of all, you have this kind of S strain, and that's kind of basically active bacteria, right? So in this case, it's something that causes pneumonia. You'd be happy that they were using stuff that caused pneumonia to study. And so what happens is actually you can actually get a R form of it in which it's actually not active anymore, right? But you can actually now what do you call it? It's called transformation. So basically some material was added to these strains so that they're now active again. So at the time, people didn't know what this stuff was. They just know that when you transform them in such a way, now they become S again, even though they were previously mutated to be the R form. Now, when you actually look at these cells, you take apart these cells, you take apart the RNA, and so that's kind of just, you know, with chromatography-ish kind of techniques, right, where you separate out DNA, different proteins, RNA, lipids, carbohydrates, and you add in each bit of these information back into separate dishes, separate groups, and you say, well, how can I get the S back? It turns out it's only when you add in the DNA back when you get the S activity back. So what that means is all you need are these crazy nucleotide-based, you know, molecules, and you have everything back. You don't need, you don't even need protein. Right? The protein doesn't even give it back to you. Because protein in that cell, it replicates once or twice, boom, gone. Right? There's no genetic modification. Right? So therefore, people hypothesize, okay, well, it must be the DNA that's giving you the genetic material. Right? So that's how people figure it out. Now, what the DNA molecule looks like, I'll show you this real fast, and I'll go back and look at my notes. Why? Why is the
first time you
the details of this you have to kind of take a look, right? So you have the phosphate group in the sugar phosphate backbone. So it's being the backbone is formed with the sugar phosphates, and then you have the bases that are kind of one for each kind of segment of that sugar phosphate, and then these bases can be G, C, A, or T, right? And then they find complementary to each other, A with T, G with C, etc. Okay? So let me go back and take a look at saying what you really need to know. So first of all, the way that these bases are kind of joined together is by hydrogen bonding. Very important. And in fact, the pyrimidines and the purines, the different bases, actually have different numbers of hydrogen bonds. Okay, I'll show you that detail later. The sugar phosphate backbone is actually has a certain polarity. That's the other part of the DNA that people don't necessarily think immediately. But it's actually, if you label the phosphate side and the OH side differently, so because phosphate, sugar, right? So therefore you have phosphate going to OH on the other end. If you label the phosphate side as 5', based on what the carbons are, basically. That's how they say 5'. Why is it 5 and 3? But it's basically 5' carbon, 3' carbon that's attached to the OH. If you label it in that way, you notice that one strand is going 5 to 3, and the complementary strand is going, 5 to 3 the other way. So in other words, going one direction, one is 5 to 3, and one is 3 to 5. So what that means is that they're anti-parallel to each other. Right. So not every molecule is like this. Some are. Right. So you have, again, some of them are purines, some of them are pyrimidines. I actually can't even remember which one is which, but anyway, ATGC. Right? But they're different. One of them has one ring, one of them has two rings. Therefore, you're getting the different numbers of hydrogen bonds. Okay. You do not have to memorize exactly which of these. Okay. So the other thing, actually, is that So one question is, why do you have this kind of complicated structure, right? But one thing that it gives you is a very efficient way of packing things together, because you have, when the 5' and 3', two anti-parallel strands form together, it turns out they actually kind of form a helix, a double helix, because of the way the bases are fitting together. Because they fit in this particular way, you have the backbone. You need the backbone in a certain orientation in order for it to help. So it's the backbone that's giving you this kind of structure, double helix, and you're getting one turn every 10 base pairs. So the anti-parallel strands is what I was saying, but it turns out because these bases are always complementary to each other when they're not wrong, right? That makes the replication very easy. So that's the thing that I want you to know, is that the reason why replication is easy is because you have complementary base pairing. If it's not the case that if it's AT only some of the time, or if it's, three-letter code with just those guys, it makes it very complicated. But because it's complementary, very straightforward, because every time you see an A, you know the other side is a T. Right? So that also means that one strand is a complete template for replicating the other, theoretically, if nothing goes wrong. So these guys are actually, I will talk about detail more, but these guys are actually sitting in the nucleus most of the time, because that's where the replication and stuff like that happens. And it's actually supported by this network of lamina. That's kind of the cytoskeletal aspects of the nucleus. So a lot of proteins, that's kind of putting things where it needs to be. And then you also have a more sort of inside part of the nucleus. Actually, a lot of times they're actually continuous with the ER, the inside of the ER. You guys might have learned this from a biology class. Because the reason is you want protein products that will be secreted, for example, to go directly into the ER in a vesicle form, and then the ER can secrete that further downstream. Yeah.
Just to confirm, it's always 5 to 3, that's the normal way?
It's just a convention, yeah.
Okay.
Just a convention for the way people describe these strands. So it just means that you're always going 5 to 3 in one direction, and then the other guy's anti-parallel going the other direction.
Okay. So in replication, that would be the leading strand?
Right. I mean, either one can serve as a leading strand.
Okay.
But it depends on where how the protein is moving. So if the protein takes the other strand as a leading strand and go the other way, 5', 3', then the other guy becomes the template.
Okay.
And that also basically determines where you open up the DNA to, right? Because if you open up the other end, the helicase working on the other side, then you're opening downstream this part instead of upstream the other part. We talk about it in replication, but yeah. Okay, so we talked about this. So this is kind of wow moment number two, right? So what these guys look like. So I guess we should remember the case that the purines are the two-ring guys, guanine and adenine. There you go. Now you guys memorized it. And the pyrimidines are the single ring C and T. Actually, you don't have to remember. Okay, so again, different number of hydrogen bonds, right? So you always have this purine and pyrimidine binding to each other. Hydrogen bond means it's a little bit weaker, but it's actually, slightly flexible in this way. And that's actually what makes it so that the DNA, even though it's in a double helix structure, also flexible, right? So it's kind of, the biology is very smart. You know, whoever designed this stuff, they know what they're doing because they want some, if these guys are inflexible, like certain proteins, like beta sheets or whatever, boom, straight through. Well, you can't move them at all. You can't store these guys. But it's very smart here because you have complementary base pairing, which makes replication easy. And you still have some flexibility to move these guys around. You can coil them around each other. They can coil around proteins. Very smart way of doing it. If I were designing a genetic system, I would do it this way too. Maybe.
Okay.
Right. If I had just the purines and pyrimidines to work with, I might come up with this. But how did you come up with the purines and pyrimidines? I don't know. Okay. Okay, anyways, this slide is good to know. Make sure you kind of know more or less what each part of those things are. So it turns out when you have the double helix, when you look at the double helix, basically, it turns out it has a major and a minor groove. And that, again, is just the way the backbones pack together. Okay, there's a lot of biochemical details I'm not giving you, but the way it packs together, it turns out you have a part where you have... It's hard to explain, isn't it? Where you have more separation between, subsequent turns, and then you have a different one where it's different separation. And that's a major and a minor group. Sorry.
But these aren't set in stone, right? So assuming the sequence happens to be like 5 A's in a row, then you wouldn't get this stuff in Nelson effect, right?
No, actually, this is depends on how the backbone is packed together.
Backbone.
Yeah. It actually does not depend on
base
pairs. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the base pairs that give it the helical.
Yeah, it might have something to do with the purines and pyrimidines, but I don't know. Let me just say I don't know. But the way that these guys are forming like that is it mostly the way the backbone is actually the 5', the 3' gives you this property. Yeah, it's actually something I should say that I don't know enough about to give you I'm not a DNA biologist enough to know. But anyway, the 5', the 3', so in vivo, it looks more like this, right? So if you notice, again, when the bases form with respect to each other, it's slightly flexible, like I was saying, and that gives you the ability to turn these guys just a little bit, right? So you have there's a 0.34 nanometer difference between subsequent phosphate groups. One guy goes 5 to 3, one guy goes 3 to 5, And then, of course, the sugars are joined together by these phosphodiester bonds. Again, these are covalent bonds on the oxygen of the phosphate. And so one thing, by the way, before anything else, if you notice, DNA is negatively charged, right? That's the simplest. Remember, because phosphate groups are negatively charged, so DNA is negatively charged. So that actually gives you a way immediately to say how you can interact with these guys, right? You have some positive charges, pull them along, etc., right? So okay, so just make sure you guys know that. Okay, this is something we will talk about in a little bit more detail later. The proteins are involved, but basically you have a double helix of DNA molecule. You separate each one, and then you can make separate strands each time. So again, this is kind of getting back to your question, Mark, is that you have ways where you can use either one as a template. When you use this upper one as a template, the replication will go in one direction. So therefore, it's so going this way, 5-3, and then you're making a new strand in that particular direction. In the other strand, you're going the other direction, but the mechanism is exactly the same. And actually doesn't even know that one is different from the other.
So how can we tell where the lucky fragments form?
Okay, we will get to that in the further lecture. You're much farther along than most people right now. But again, the Okazaki fragment forms the leading strand. So it forms in the place where you're expecting the next piece to be. So basically, when the polymerase binds, it opens it up in a certain way so that the helicase is binding downstream of that. And basically, this information is transmitted, I don't have it in front of me, but so that you know you need to go that particular direction. Yeah, but anyway, it's oriented in a specific way, which makes it so that replication doesn't matter which strand you're using particularly, it's just going in a specific direction every time. Right. And the repair also goes on, actually, as this is happening, actually. So it's making it checking. We're not going to have time to talk too much about that, but I will mention it. Okay. So, again, the genes are basically the guys that are found in the DNA, right? So a particular gene needs to... So when we say gene, actually, it just actually means the segment of DNA that leads to expression of some protein, actually. It's a very simple definition. But what that means is that most DNA actually is not genes, actually. It's some useless... Well, you think it's useless. You think it's useless. It may or may not be useless. There's many different ways of interpreting what's going on in this little section, introns. So I already a little bit talked about this, but basically what we're concerned with is all this stuff that's within the nucleus. You also have a region called the nucleolus where the rRNA is concentrated. So the guys have become ribosome. Again, we were talking about this earlier, but when the cell division happens, you have these kind of formations of specific structures. So, and then you have also cytoskeleton that's kind of outside nucleus. And within the nucleus, you have these nuclear lamina that forms a network in which you can embed your DNA or chromosomes, become chromosomes. And the nuclear envelope actually has a lot of proteins that regulate traffic into and out of. So they're called nuclear pore complexes. So they're regulated by proteins. So these little dots here are actually proteins. Yeah. It's continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. Yeah. Okay. So the next step up, once we know what a DNA molecule is how they're organized further on, right? So first of all, it's the nucleus is very small. Right, 6 micron. I mean, that's a very rough figure, but different cells are different. But when you actually look at the amount of information in the DNA, you're looking at like the area of meters. So you're fitting in meters of information into microns of diameters of nuclei, right? So what that means is that you have to have really efficient packing, right? So in the human beings, you have 46 chromosomes total. So when people say chromatin, that actually just means the DNA plus the proteins are associated with it. So not quite chromosome yet, because chromosome is a little bit higher level. So chromatin is just the way that, so the next level up is basically chromatin is DNA and plus the proteins are associated, and that's binding around, right? So you have a mom, most of us have moms and dads, and they have homologous, they give us homologous copies. Some of us don't. Yeah. I don't have both. So homologous copies means that you actually have 22 pairs of chromosomes. These are kind of the regular chromosomes. And then you also have X and or Y, right? So guys have X plus Y, girls have X plus X. And one of the X's is actually inactivated. And I'll tell you how they inactivated later. So when you, the way you study this is actually you hybridize probes. So probes are actually just DNA fragments, actually, that actually allows you to have some readout, for example, fluorescence or something like that. So you hybridize a probe to, for example, in mitosis or some other cellular process, and you can actually look at how the DNA is changing over time in mitosis, for example. And so what they're saying is actually painting, right? It's like DNA painting, right? So karyotype is actually the full set of chromosomes, right? So it's just a term we say when you actually look at the full set of chromosomes at mitosis. So that's key. Because outside of mitosis, it turns out these guys are all kind of decondensed, right, into less visible structures that kind of just floating around different parts of the nucleus. During mitosis, actually, these guys kind of condense into this chromosome form that you can paint and kind of easily see very well. And the kind of the set of those guys is the karyotype. When people say your karyotype is your picture of the chromosomes at mitosis. You know, for example, you can diagnose whether someone has, you know, fragile X syndrome or whatever, Down syndrome, whatever, by looking at their set of chromosomes, whether there's a break at one of their chromosomes, for example. Right. So each of the pairs actually stay in the same way. So the guys and the dad and the moms, they might not be completely identical, but they stay in the same way. They look similar in the spanning pattern. So what I said earlier is important is that you have a lot of junk. When we say junk, that actually means we don't know what they do, really. I mean, we know in some way. We know some sense that you don't need them for certain processes, like gene, you know, like it doesn't code for a gene. Because you take them out, you run the ribosome, basically. Nonsense. That guy just gets degraded, whatever you made. Or it doesn't even make it. Like, the process doesn't even continue. But historically, basically, people think of this quote-unquote junk as kind of stuff from a long time ago that we're inheriting through evolution. You're keeping all that stuff around because the selection process for getting rid of them is not high. You know, it doesn't matter whether you have or not, then why get rid of them? You just keep them around. It's like all the junk you collect in your house, right? It's like, why do I have this? Well, nobody's telling me to clean up my room, so, you know. Now, some people get told to clean up their room, and guess what? They clean up their room. So you have, like, puffer fish, right? Where you start getting rid of that shit, right? So kind of, you know, it's evolutionary pressure. And what I said also is basically most of the DNA segments, right, most are non-coding stuff that we inherited. So, for example, a lot, actually mostly, are what are called transposons. You might have heard those before. Transposons are kind of these mobile elements that you can actually move from one section of DNA to another. Most of the time, they're being duplicated. I mean, I'm not talking about just, like, one duplication. I'm talking about, like, boom, 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 like, shitloads of copies everywhere. This is kind of like cat dump, you know? It's like, it's like everywhere. Right. Once it gets somewhere, boom, it's just like, yeah. Entropy. It's like entropy. Huh? Pretty much. I mean, it's not, so one transposon would be one sequence, but there's many different transposons, so therefore many different sequences. And sometimes, of course, this causes you to have a gene deletion or whatever, or sometimes it improves your, protein that you make. So, anyways, so the point of this is that I show you that beautiful DNA structure, all this order, but most of it is entropy. Like, most of it is just stuff being put in places they shouldn't be, your kitchen, Yeah. Okay, I have a few minutes left. So this is what a karyotype looks like. If you have all 46 of these guys, X and Y, or in this case, X and X, painting looks pretty cool. You can actually see them moving around in vivo. Yeah. So the reason these look like they're kind of crossed, it's not painting the centromere, but it's because during the mitosis, actually, when they're lined up in the same way, actually not mitosis per se, but kind of the metaphase where they actually are joined together. So those two pairs of chromosome copies actually join at this place called the centromere, which I'll talk about actually, like, substantially, because that's how you're kind of, right, you have the kinetochore complex, and that's kind of pulled apart the two different sides using spindles, which are microtubules. I'll talk about that later. Okay, so this is what the karyotypes actually look like when you map. So we know that actually the human genome's already mapped. So
the white stuff useless or the black stuff?
This case actually is just the way they paint it. It's not, it's based on the probe that they're using. Yeah, I can't tell you that it's introns versus exons. Yeah, it actually depends on the probe. Yeah, so I think if you guys can stay just a little bit, I'm going to try to kind of complete this part of the story and then let you guys go. Okay, so one thing is that, so when you look at yeast, so remember yeast is one of those creatures that we said actually don't have so much redundancy, right? So you can see it here. When you look at the actual genes, right, when you look at the entire basically genome of yeast, you have actually a lot of coding sequences as opposed to just a few. But human beings, if you look, shitload of just stuff that, I wouldn't be able to publish this lecture. This is too profanity lame. Maybe sometime it's okay. So you have fewer genes and you have a lot of nonsense, right? But actually that makes us very human. It doesn't correlate so well. So it doesn't mean that you have lots of chromosomes that you're automatically complex, or a lot of DNA. Because if you look at this Chinese moon, I don't know how to say it, Munchak, and an Indian Munchak, they look, these guys look the same, right? I mean, if I give you this picture one after the other, you have no idea, right?
One's a baby
mother. Yeah, maybe. One of them has white. Maybe that's what that white antler is, the thing that you need all that ivory. But if you look at the chromosome, it's just, you can't, it's not predictable in that sense. It's very complicated evolutionary history.
Three sex cells?
Yeah, in this case, yeah. That's the other very good observation. I mean, I don't know if it's Indian Moonjack. I can't tell you, like, all the little processes that are going on in the Indian Moonjack. But, yeah, in this case, it's characterized, I don't know. It depends on whether you need both. I guess in this case, probably they need both in order to be characterized as the male, but I don't know. So there's some breakage event, probably. The only thing I can say is there's probably some breakage event earlier on in their history that led to this. Yeah, and it was conserved over time. And this kind of just illustrates what I was saying before, that you have these 22 chromosomes, and they kind of, if you look more and more detail, you open them up, right? So the chromosome, which is this chromatin complex, you look at these guys, only 10% of this particular area has genes, and that's kind of very representative of what you usually see. And then within the gene, actually, a lot of it actually is intron, which is stuff that you don't need to kind of code for it. Only the exon is useful, so you're getting rid of all that stuff basically during transcription, okay? And then once you actually look at the gene itself, a lot of it is just regulatory. It's not even real gene per se. All right, so this is kind of what I was saying. Exons, actually small part of his exon. This is actually pretty representative of the bigger picture, is that mostly it's intron, which means it's stuff that gets excised out, that people don't use. Most of it is this exon stuff that you join together. And once you join all that stuff together, then you can use that transcript to make RNA. Or actually, that is the RNA transcript that's made from the introns. That's what we should say. Right? Because the DNA replicates everything. And that leads to protein. Protein becomes folded. Yeah. So let me see where I should stop. Hold on. Okay, I will stop before nucleosome, histone kind of stuff. So we will stop right here, I think. Yeah. So we're pretty much done. So next time, remind me, I forget, we're going to start with nucleosomes. That's kind of the next order up. But let me just quickly go over this stuff, and then I can let you go. Anyways, I'm still on time, so actually I don't need to worry. I can keep you guys here forever.
No.
Yeah. So... Oh, yeah. So first of all, we talked about this actually the first day, but realized that actually the critical function coding genes, so in other words, that stuff that's coding for proteins that's super necessary for your everyday survival, are the ones that are conserved, the ones that are not changing over time when you look at the genomes of different organism families. Right? That's important. So that's how you study these guys. You look at conserved regions. Conserved meaning over evolutionary history is the same sequence. Okay. Now, the complexity of organisms usually, this is a very general statement, but it usually correlates with the number of genes that you have. But that's not the size, right? Remember, because the yeast has lots of genes, but not a big size, right? But it still has a certain level of complexity. So therefore, the number of genes would give you a rough idea of how complex you are. So the human beings have a great number of genes, but if you look at a whale or something, you know, it's different. Okay. If you need to go, it's okay. In general, I think it's a little bit smaller than that, but I have it written here that about a third of these actually code for proteins, right? So these genes, basically. You also have... the genes are actually, when you look at the different species with these genes, so look at one species versus another in evolutionary history, sometimes you get the genes in a similar order along a DNA. And the process of that, the phenomenon you see that is called syntony, and it's where you have that same order, more or less, of genes across different species. Not just that you're getting the same genes, but in that order. Right, it's called syntony. So in the actual process of the cell, so we need to talk about the cell cycle because this is how we study them, you know, so in terms of karyotyping and stuff like that. So during interphase is actually where you have DNA replication happening, and during that replication process, the DNA is actually decondensed, so in other words, it's kind of spread out, right? It's concentrated in certain parts of the nucleus, but you can't visualize it per se, as these karyotypes. And that's when actually you have replication. It's called interphase. During mitosis, now you condense those guys, you get the chromosomes out, and you kind of pull those guys apart, and they're in a condensed form. Most of the time, of course, you're actually in interphase. You're not doing any mitosis, right? So most of the time, it's up. Central mirror is what I talked about before. It's connecting those two pairs from the mom and dad chromosomes together, right? So you have the protein kinetochore. The kinetochore is the thing that is the protein part of the central mirror, basically. It's the protein complex of that, and basically it attaches the chromosome to the actual cytoskeletal spindles, right? They're microtubules. So it's the kinetochore is the protein that connects these guys. You know, it's right next to the kind of the central mirror. You can also have actually more interesting parts of the chromosome. So the central mirror I started talking about is the sequence that are kind of forming that center part of the karyotype. But the telomere is actually the end of the DNAs, right? And it turns out the ends of the DNA actually are repeat segments, like C-A-C-A-C-A-C-A-C-A, for example, like shitload of times, right, for example. And actually, a couple of things, but one thing is that because you have just random repeats, obviously, not random, just complete repeats, they're not going to code for actual anything meaningful. But what that means is it protects you, right? Because if your replication kind of messes up at the edges, boom, you mess up. Once you mess up that protein, you're screwed, right? If you're already close to the edge. But in this case, it just keeps, it doesn't matter if you messed up a bunch of time, you're just messing up a bunch of CAs, you know. Eventually, that leads to nothing. It doesn't code for any protein. The protein stop codon already happened, and it finished. So it protects you from, you know, sort of inaccurate replication. Now, you also actually, turns out, have many origins of replication in DNA, not just one particular area. You actually start replicating in many different areas. So you look like, it looks like the Matrix, right? It's like this huge DNA molecule, boom, it's starting in all kinds of different places. That's actually how the replicating proceeds, not just like one linear sequence or even just a few Okazaki fragments. Okay, so this is what I already talked about, interface most of the time, and then when you have the M phase of mitosis, the cell division happens. This is what the chromosome looks like when it's at the M phase, right, during mitosis metaphase. And then, finally, this is kind of what I was saying, that you have these origins of replication that happen in more than one place, and you have the central mirrors is where the sister chromatids actually join, right? And when you have everything replicated, they're joined in this particular way. And then here is the kinetochore complex, this green stuff, because this is the stuff that's actually joining to the mitotic spindle. So those are microtubules, which are part of the cytoskeleton. And then after this happens, you have two separate guys again, so the same thing that you end up with, but they're duplicated and they're found in different cell compartments with their own membranes. Yeah, so next time, I will start with nucleosomes and then try to finish this lecture. And then we have, I guess, one more lecture after that, I believe. And hopefully you get to replication and then whatever beyond that I can get to. So, thank you.